And well, Scott get his got some excellent discography of the Rachmaninoff piano concerto, a big box there. Well, he put the things here. I have just a brief announcements about this evening. For all of you who are interested in attending some of the event this evening, look at this yellow sheet there at the registration desk. Everything, virtually everything, will take place in this building. If you have your schedule, please make some small corrections. The Kermit Gray re-recording Edison Cylinders will be only half an hour from 7:30 to 8, and it will take place in the Plaza room, right, one room right there. Then between 8 and 8:45, we will have a very excellent presentation, Portraits from the Golden Age of Jazz, portrait by William Godley. So he will be presenting the slide right here in this large Pearson Hall, where we're gonna have the banquet tomorrow. Then 8:45 to 9:45, don't forget the Hal Heckendorn, two movies, one the Toscanini film, Hymn of the Nations, complete uncut, and then the last rehearsal of Blanche Thibon and Ezio Pinza. When he finishes with that, at 9:45, we'll have Fred Williams, the Willow Grove Park Concerts, 1896-1925, that will go from 9:45 to 11:30 p.m., at which time we'll move to the dormitory and Fred Williams will continue there with the presentation of the Banda Chieti, a military band from Italy in the 1930s that takes 7 hours, so we'll go from midnight to 7 a.m. and you will be ready at 7:30 to have breakfast here. So that's the program for this evening. So I got one offer by letter from Scott Colbank one day about a discography of the Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto. It sounded very interesting. And then he sent me an excellent, very, very impressive, very well-researched discography. I don't know how long it took him. It is very impressive. So Scott will be talking now on the compilation of the discography, and he will be playing also comparison of various performances of the Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto No. 3. So as I say, I'm very, very impressed with the discography and the research work of Scott Colbank. So here he will talk to you about his work on Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 3. Scott? He has a discography here. Anybody who wants is in this box here in front.
Yeah. Does everyone have one so far?
Well, good afternoon. So my name is Scott Colbank, and I'm from nearby Topeka, Kansas. And I'm honored to address the ARSC convention for the first time today. Although I have been an ARSC member for several years, this has been my first opportunity to attend and participate in an ARSC event. I'd like to thank the Executive Committee for choosing Kansas City as this year's convention site, as upon learning this, gave me the inspiration to resume work on my research project, a Rachmaninoff Piano Concerto No. 3 discography, which has seen little done to it in the last 2 years. Several ARSC members have responded to notices I had placed in the ARSC newsletter about 3 years ago, advertising earlier and far less complete versions of the discography now before you. Response to constructive criticism and much additional research and listening to recordings in my collection since January has yielded a fourth edition of this discography, which will be of much greater use to all people interested in this composition. It is my hope that by distributing this latest edition to all members present today, that I may find some individuals who will be able to help me complete the discography so it may eventually be published in the journal. To help illustrate the cadenzas, cuts, and variations in interpretation of this Rachmaninoff concerto, I would like to play brief excerpts from several of the Rachmaninoff Third Concerto's recordings in my collection. To start off, I would like to demonstrate two extremes in tempi taken at the beginning of the first movement. Zoltán Kocsis' recording, number 35, illustrates the faster than usual tempo. Exactly the opposite is Alexis Weissenberg's third recording, number 65. Thankfully, most other interpretations fall somewhere in between these two extremes. As noted in the introduction to the discography, two first movement cadenzas were written by Rachmaninoff. The most played or regular version is here performed by Alexis Weissenberg in his first recording, number 63.
Thank you.
The alternate and probably more difficult to perform version is here illustrated by Vladimir Ashkenazy in his fourth recording, number 6. Well-played version of each cadenza. Here, however, is an example of how not to play the alternate cadenza. In recording number 22, Walter Gieseking gives it his best effort and comes up a little short. This will be about the last two-thirds of the cadenza.
Thank you.
All four cuts Rachmaninoff sanctioned, in my opinion, are unfortunate and unnecessary. Thankfully, the practice of taking one or more of the cuts started to go out of favor in about 1970, and few recordings since that date have any cuts. The longest and most damaging is the first of the two cuts taken in the finale. This section of the finale, approximately 1.5 minutes after the beginning, is played in the uncut version in a new recording by Vladimir Feltzman, recording number 18. Now, to illustrate the cut, Earl Wilde, in recording number 66, takes only 35 seconds to play what Feltzman took in 1 minute and 25 seconds, both pianists taking similar tempos. What I have found interesting is that the total time of all four cuts is approximately 2.5 to 3 minutes, depending on the tempos. This would hardly seem necessary in a work that normally takes 40 to 45 minutes to perform. The discography contains performances that range from top-notch to barely adequate. 9 pianists have recorded the work at least twice, with Vladimir Ashkenazy doing it 4 times. Among my favorites are the first recordings by Ashkenazy, Gavrilov, Horowitz, and Weissenberg, and CD versions by Bolette and Feltzman. To conclude today's presentation, however, I would like to play excerpts from 2 recordings a little on the bizarre side. Love or hate compact discs, you will have to agree that one advantage they do have is eliminating LP side breaks that come mid-movement in works such as the Berlioz Symphony Fantastique and Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. Rachmaninoff third LP recordings normally don't, and indeed should never have this problem, with the first movement taking up side one and the other two movements side two. Recording number 42, featuring pianist Viktor Mirzhanov and the recording engineers at Monitor Records in their infinite wisdom, is a notable exception. This excerpt starts near the end of the second movement. Thank you.
That's my nomination for the worst side break of all times. Walter Gieseking, heard a little earlier in his memorable rendition of the alternate cadenza, is also featured in recording number 23, which is easily the strangest and one of the worst performances I've ever heard. Willem Mingelberg conducts the only recording I have heard of this work where the orchestration has been tampered with. If you're familiar with the work, you're going to hear two timpani, I'll just call them outbursts, that are not in the score. If you're not that familiar with the work, just appreciate the interpretation you're about to hear. Here are short excerpts from the endings of the second and third movements. In case you're curious, he butchered the cadenza in that recording too. And why that one was ever reissued on CD has me speechless. In the few minutes I have left, I would enjoy answering any questions or hearing any comments on my project.
I can send you some additional information. Gina Buckhauer's husband was her conductor, and Alex Sherman.
Alex Sherman, right. Yeah.
And if I, do you have the Horowitz? The timings that you don't have that aren't in here?
Some of the timings.
You have.
The timings are based at this point only if they were on the label or on the jacket.
Okay.
If it's not listed, I just didn't have time to go through. But where it says the key, well, in the introduction, it shows which recordings that I lack. And on those recordings, I have no information other than the what is here.
And one that you just played a few minutes ago, you have cuts possible, but you haven't had time to analyze it yet for cuts. The Russian one, I think it was.
Or Merzhanov?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one I just have not played all the way through.
Okay.
Thank you.
Dave Canfield, Bloomington.
Hi, Dave.
Hi. My compliments on an informative and interesting project and a presentation. I'm wanting to ask you, for items such as item number 50, I'm no expert on Rachmaninoff third recordings, but is your aim not to be complete with regard to all foreign issues? Because I see that you do not list the German and the English, for instance, issues of the LP transfers of the recordings in item number 50. So are you limiting yourself in your discography just to American? I see other foreign recordings there, so I'm not sure what your goal is.
No, not at all. This is just, that would just be another example of where I haven't been able to come up with the original issue numbers. No, the intent is to have all...
All of the foreign issues as well.
Right.
Yes.
That
I'm sure you'll
that
have some people...
I can find or are supplied to me.
I'm sure there'll be some people here, including myself, who can help you fill in some of these then.
Thank you. Great.
Seth Winter, Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives. You brought up about that the Geiser King Mengelberg recording. I'm surprised you didn't bring up about the Geiser King Barbaroli, which everyone thought was so wonderful. I thought that was a worse performance than what we just heard. Barbaroli's conducting out is far more off the mark than what Geiser King was doing with it, than Mengelberg. And it's also a well-known fact, from what I understand, Geiser King rarely practiced, and I have a funny feeling Mengelberg was just pulling him along on that. The collaboration in the second concerto was much more effective, from what I remember. There's also a Franck Symphonic Variations, which is kind of a mess like this, where Geiser King cannot follow Mengelberg for anything and is hitting wrong notes left and right.
Yeah, I have the Barbaroli recording, and I agree that it is equally as bad. Why he chose to play the alternate cadenza...
The man apparently had a photographic memory. He could look at something and play it note perfect 50 years later type routine, but unfortunately when he didn't practice, that's the kind of result you hear.
The reason I chose the Mengelberg edition for the presentation was because what he did with the Tempanist.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, was Mengelberg one to fool around with the orchestration?
Most definitely.
Okay.
And tempo-wise, most definitely. In fact, the old running joke used to be, if you took Mengelberg and Stokowski, throw them in a closet, see who would come out alive.
Steve Smolian, in defense of Mengelberg, for the moment, it's important, even tracing back to looking at the various scores Mahler used in various concert halls, it's important to remember that the Concertgebouw is a hall in the round. The stage is in the middle and the audience surrounds them. In the case of the timpani, of course, there's little justification for altering the rhythmic emphasis, but frequently, even today, orchestrations have changed to suit halls particularly, even though it's not widely acknowledged, and it certainly was true of a lot of the Concertgebouw performances. If you look at the Mahler 4th, the original edition in the States, the one with the fold-over cover, I guess it was the original Phillips import, actually. There's a copy of a page of the Mahler 4th with Mengelberg's, is it Mengelberg's or Mahler's annotations to it? I don't recall now, but I know it's heavily, yeah. And frequently those are simply a result of some things being audible in one hall and not audible in another, or in one hall or one design and not in another.
Okay. Well, I've appreciated addressing you all today and enjoy your stay in Kansas City.